August 22nd, 1992. Brandon, Mississippi. While driving his girlfriend home, 18-year-old Andre Jones is stopped at a police sobriety checkpoint and is taken into custody on a number of charges after the pickup truck he is driving is determined to be stolen. Andre is transferred to the Simpson County Jail, but over 19 hours after his arrival, he is found hanging in a shower stall with one of his own shoelaces, and the authorities rule his death to be a suicide. However, Andre's family believes he was the victim of a racially motivated murder, but while an investigation is launched into a number of suspicious suicides which took place in various Mississippi jails during this time period, there are no conclusive answers about what happened. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and we're going to be exploring a very controversial case which was featured on Unsolved Mysteries, the unexplained 1994 death of Andre Jones. As you probably know, one case which has been covered extensively on The Trail Went Cold and my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, is the 1986 death of Keith Warren, which was recently the subject of a new three-part documentary series titled Uprooted, which aired on Discovery Plus. In case you're not familiar with it, Keith Warren was a 19-year-old black man from the suburbs of Silver Spring, Maryland, who was found hanging from a tree by a noose in a scene that seemed to resemble a lynching, and even though there were a number of suspicious discrepancies pointing towards foul play, the authorities ruled his death to be a suicide. The victim in today's case, 18-year-old Andre Jones, was another young black man who died under similar circumstances, but the key difference is that Andre's death took place while he was being held in a county jail following an arrest by police. Much like Keith Warren, Andre did not have any history of trouble with the law and was on the verge of starting college, but after being held in custody for nearly 24 hours, he was found hanging in a shower stall with one of his shoelaces wrapped around his neck. Since Andre's death took place in Mississippi, and both his mother and stepfather were prominent activists in the community, this led to speculation that he might have been the victim of a racially motivated murder, and the incident would pretty much blow the lid off a major scandal. Andre was just one of 47 inmates who had died by a hanging inside various Mississippi jails during this time period, and even though all these deaths were ruled to be suicide, many of the victims' families disagreed. While Andre's case would be investigated by numerous agencies, including the United States Department of Justice, they all reached the conclusion that his death was a suicide, but even so, there are some troubling discrepancies which need to be addressed. And regardless of whether those 47 deaths were homicides or suicides, they pointed to a major systemic problem which we'll be discussing on this episode. Anyway, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the death of Andre Jones. Our story begins in Mississippi in 1992, and our central figure is 18-year-old Andre Jones, who lives in the capital city of Jackson. Andre hails from a family who has a significant presence in the local black community, as his mother, Esther Jones Quinn, is president of the Jackson branch of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, aka the NAACP, and his stepfather, Charles X. Quinn, is a minister at a Nation of Islam mosque. Andre's birth father, Alonzo Jones, lives over an hour away in the town of Port Gibson, and during the era of the Civil Rights Movement, he was known for driving black residents to the courthouse so they could finally register to vote. At this particular point, Andre has recently graduated high school and is only a few days away from starting his freshman year at Alcorn State University in Lorman. He is planning to study engineering and has spent the summer working as an electrical apprentice for a local engineering company. On the evening of Friday, August the 21st, Andre went out with his girlfriend, Tanisha Love, in an S10 Chevrolet pickup truck that he had borrowed from a friend of his over 1 week earlier. They returned to Andre's home at 11:45 p.m., where he told his mother and stepfather that they were planning to go to Tanisha's house in the nearby town of Brandon, located about 13 miles east. The couple soon left together, but at around 1:30 a.m. on the morning of August the 22nd, Esther and Charles were woken up by a phone call from Tanisha, who told them that Andre had just been arrested. She claimed that when Andre drove her to Brandon, their truck was stopped by the police at a routine sobriety checkpoint at the city limits before Andre was taken into custody. Well, sure enough, about a half hour after hearing from Tanisha, the Quins received a phone call from Andre, who confirmed that he was at the Brandon Police Department, but claimed that he had no idea what he'd been arrested for. Shortly after 4 a.m., Andre phoned Esther and Charles again and told them that he was supposed to be held at the Rankin County Jail, but since it was overcrowded, he had been transferred to the Simpson County Jail in Mendenhall, which was located about 35 miles away. Over the course of the day, the Quins would speak to Andre on the phone three more times, but he continued to maintain that he had no idea why he'd been arrested or what he was being charged with. Even though the Quins claimed they attempted to speak with someone in charge, no one from the jail would talk to them or tell them anything, only that they were not allowed to go there to visit Andre. Esther last spoke with Andre on the phone at around 6 p.m., but when midnight arrived, a Jackson police officer showed up at the Quinn residence and handed Esther a piece of paper which contained nothing more than a phone number for the Simpson County Jail, which she was supposed to call. When Esther dialed the number, she was horrified to receive the news that Andre had taken his own life. The official story was that after Andre arrived at the jail, he was placed inside cell 6, an L-shaped corridor which had been converted into a holding cell containing 7 bunk beds. Andre was housed in there alongside 11 other inmates, and at 7 p.m., the door was opened to allow them to attend a church service. Andre declined to attend the service and remained in his cell until the other inmates returned 1 hour later. The cell contained a dimly lit shower stall, and at some point during the evening, Andre asked one of the inmates, Garrison Spann, how to use it. Andre would later enter the stall, and sometime after 11 p.m., Spann would speak to another inmate who wanted to use the shower, but noticed that Andre had been in there for around 45 minutes without coming out. When Spann walked into the stall to check on Andre, he discovered him crouching in a corner facing the wall, and even though the water was running, Andre still had his clothes on. Upon closer inspection, Spann discovered that Andre had a shoelace tied around his neck and a noose, and he had seemingly hanged himself by tying the other end of the lace to an iron grate above the showerhead. When the inmates called for help, Andre was pronounced dead at the scene. The shoelace had been taken from one of his Air Jordan sneakers, which was found on a heater above his bunk bed. On the surface, it seemed like Andre's death was a suicide, as a number of his cellmates would describe him as being anxious and worried about possibly facing prison time, and it was believed that this fear may have driven him to take his own life. However, Andre's family had a hard time believing this explanation, as they said he had never shown any signs of depression or suicidal tendencies, and was greatly looking forward to attending college. Up until this point, Andre had never been in trouble with the law, and the Quins found the circumstances of his arrest to be very questionable. The police's version of events is that when Andre's truck pulled up to the sobriety checkpoint in Brandon, they asked him for his driver's license. When Andre said he didn't have his license on him, they told him to pull over to the shoulder of the road, but while he was doing this, an officer noticed Andre tossing an object out of the driver's side window, which turned out to be a loaded .38 caliber handgun. Upon closer inspection of the truck, officers discovered an open can of beer, which Andre had attempted to hide under the front seat. Even though Andre claimed that he had only borrowed the truck from a friend of his, a check on the license plate revealed that it had tags which had been stolen from a 1988 Ford Mustang in Clinton, and the truck's vehicle identification number had also been altered. It would later be established that the truck itself had been reported stolen from outside a store in Jackson on July the 22nd. In total, Andre would be arrested and booked on 4 separate charges: carrying a concealed weapon, driving with an open container of alcohol, driving a truck whose vehicle identification number had been altered, and possession of stolen license plate tags. After Andre was taken to the Brandon police station, he apparently proved to be so cooperative and willing to share information that Police Chief Walter Tucker was brought in to hear what he had to say. Andre told Chief Tucker that he was involved with a gang called the Folks, who operated out of Jackson. In fact, he allowed the police to take 17 Polaroid photographs of him, using his hands to showcase various gang signals, provided that his face wasn't shown. Andre also allegedly said that he had borrowed the stolen truck from someone he only knew as Slim, and that he had bought the handgun he was carrying on the streets of Jackson 1 year earlier. Well, Andre's girlfriend Tanisha shared a much different story about how his arrest took place. She denied that Andre had tossed a gun out of the truck, or that he had an open container of beer inside. After Andre pulled over to the shoulder of the road, one of the officers asked him for his name, and once he shared it, the police's attitude seemed to completely change. According to Tanisha, the officers at the scene appeared to gather together into a huddle to quietly talk about something before they asked Andre to step out of the truck. After this, Andre was handcuffed and had his feet shackled before he was arrested. For their part, police maintained that the arrest was non-confrontational and denied Tanisha's claim that Andre was shackled. However, Andre's family had a hard time believing their story about him admitting to his affiliation with a gang, as there was no mention of this in the original arrest report. The Brandon PD also denied the Quinn's request to turn over the photos of Andre displaying gang signals with his hands. When Unsolved Mysteries covered this story a year and a half later, the request to see the photos was also denied, and as far as I can tell, these photos have never been released publicly. Charles Quinn decided to perform his own independent investigation into Andre's death and spoke with Archie Beaufort, an inmate who had been arrested for a DUI at the same police sobriety checkpoint and was with Andre when he was transferred from the Rankin County Jail to the Simpson County Jail. According to Charles, Beaufort told him that the officers used racial slurs in order to intimidate Andre, and one of them used the N-word when they stated, quote, "Do you know what happens to people like you for stealing a white man's truck?" Beaufort also said that Andre was worried about something the Brandon PD was trying to pin on him, as they had apparently told him he could get 15 years in prison. Charles also spoke to an inmate from the Simpson County Jail who claimed that he had seen some officers take Andre from the cell block to an unknown location. When the officers returned at a later time, Andre was in a wheelchair and taken into the shower stall in cell 6, where his body was laid on the floor before his hanging was staged to look like a suicide. However, none of the other inmates who were being held in cell 6 that night corroborated this story. They denied ever having seen Andre brought into the cell in a wheelchair and claimed that they never saw any violence or threats levied against Andre during his time at the jail. According to Garrison Spann, the inmate who discovered Andre's body, quote, "There was no way for anybody to have got to him because I sleep right by the shower door, and if something had happened, I would have heard a struggle," end quote. On the other hand, the grate in the shower stall which Andre's shoelace had been tied to was located 8 feet above the floor. There was some doubt about whether Andre would have been physically capable of hanging himself from that height without the assistance of a second person or a stool to step off of, but no stool was found at the scene. Andre's autopsy was performed by Dr. Stephen Hain, a state-approved pathologist who concluded that Andre's death was a suicide. According to Dr. Hain, investigators from the Simpson County Sheriff's Office performed their own demonstration in the shower stall to see if it was possible for Andre to have hanged himself from the grate above the shower head, and one officer was able to simulate it successfully without assistance. There was some debate about whether the shoelace would have been strong enough to support the weight of Andre's body, but Hain claimed that Andre's laces were tested by the manufacturer, who determined that it was possible. According to officials from Nike, a shoelace from a pair of Air Jordan sneakers could routinely endure 159 pounds of pressure, and while Andre weighed 160 pounds, the string would not have needed to support his entire body weight since he was found in a crouching position with his knees bent and his feet touching the floor. When Andre bent his knees, he could have put pressure on his neck and carotid arteries and lost consciousness within 10 to 12 seconds. Since Charles X. Quinn was a minister of the Nation of Islam, he was able to get in touch with the head of the organization, Louis Farrakhan, who pledged his support to get to the bottom of Andre's death, and even performed a eulogy at his funeral. Farrakhan put the Quinns in touch with Dr. James Bryant, an independent pathologist from Chicago, who agreed to review the case and came to the conclusion that Andre had been strangled to death and was the victim of foul play. According to Dr. Bryant, it would have been impossible for Andre to hang himself while in a crouching position, stating, quote, "The body has automatic reflexes so that you cannot tie a noose around your neck, bend your knees, and stay there until you're dead. This is a fairy tale," end quote. Bryant believed that the ligature marking on Andre's neck was inconsistent with hanging, as the mark would have been along the side of his neck and wouldn't have gone all the way around. In Andre's case, the ligature marking went all the way around to the back of his head and crisscrossed, which suggested that someone had wrapped a ligature around Andre's neck from behind. In addition, there did not appear to be an imprint of a knot mark on Andre's skin, though Dr. Hain argued that the knot could have been positioned above Andre's hairline on the upper surface of his neck, where his hair would act as a buffer to prevent the imprint. However, Bryant countered this by pointing out that Andre's hair had been cut short, and the crisscross marking was not positioned in the hairline, and there were no knot marks anywhere else. While Hain's autopsy report listed no evidence of bruising on Andre's neck or body, Bryant claimed that there was some bruising under one of Andre's eyes, as well as one of his shoulders. Bryant could not be certain if the bruising was caused by Andre's death or another incident which might have taken place at an earlier time, but he believed that Andre had suffered some sort of blunt trauma while he was incarcerated. However, it must be noted that Bryant never directly examined Andre's body and was basing his conclusions largely on a description which had been provided by one of the jailers. He had to acknowledge that there was no evidence of a struggle on Andre's body, such as the presence of another person's skin beneath his fingernails, and concluded that if Andre was murdered, it was likely at the hands of another inmate rather than a law enforcement official. Well, in spite of Dr. Bryant's conclusions, Dr. Hain's autopsy findings were reviewed by a number of different agencies, including the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology, the U.S. Department of Justice, the U.S. Attorney's Office, and the FBI, and while none of them ever went to the trouble of exhuming Andre's body for a new examination, they all concluded that the original suicide ruling was correct. Andre's death was investigated by a local black newspaper called the Jackson Advocate, and their views were often at odds with Jackson's main newspaper, the Clarion Ledger, where many of the writers and editors believed the official conclusion of suicide. There was additional controversy over the fact that the Simpson County Sheriff at the time was 64-year-old Lloyd Jones, who was nicknamed Goon by the black community for his crude racism and brutality. Jones had been a feared law enforcement officer during the Civil Rights era and was present for a number of violent, race-related incidents during that time period. In fact, in 1966, when Jones was a state trooper, he tear-gassed none other than Martin Luther King Jr. and some other activists who had set up a tent on public grounds for a demonstration in the town of Clinton. Even though he wasn't particularly popular with the black residents of Simpson County, Jones was re-elected as sheriff on numerous occasions due to his tough-on-crime stance. This led to rumors that Andre's death could have been a vengeful, racially motivated murder because his mother and stepfather were prominent black activists in the area. For his part, Sheriff Jones claimed that he was at home at the time Andre was booked into the Simpson County Jail, and while he went to the jail later that day, he had left to go to a deer camp he owned in Warren County by the time Andre's death took place. Jones maintained that he had no idea who Andre's mother and stepfather were until after Andre died, and denied the allegations that a murderous conspiracy took place inside his jail. Well, in March of 1993, Andre's story would receive nationwide attention when the Commission on Human Rights Abuses in Mississippi, a coalition of civil rights groups, decided to hold a two-day hearing at the State Capitol building in Jackson. It turned out that Andre was just one of 47 inmates, 24 of them black and 23 of them white, who had died via hanging in various jails throughout Mississippi during a period ranging from May of 1987 until February of 1993. While all of these deaths were ruled to be suicides, there were a number of questionable discrepancies which convinced many of the victims' families that foul play had taken place, and they would provide testimony throughout the hearings. Some harrowing testimony was provided by a former deputy sheriff named Andrea Gibbs, who had worked at the Harrison County Jail and Juvenile Detention Facility in Gulfport. Gibbs, who was white, claimed that she witnessed the inmates suffer constant beatings at the hands of correctional officers, and when Gibbs and three black deputies attempted to report these abuses to their superiors, they were all fired. At one point during the hearings, the Jackson Advocate published the headline, quote, "Jailhouse suicide could be new lynching mode," and the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights would recommend that the U.S. Department of Justice open a new investigation. President Bill Clinton even publicly commented that he was, quote-unquote, very much concerned by the abnormally high number of deaths which were taking place in Mississippi jails, and under the order of Attorney General Janet Reno, the Civil Rights Division of the DOJ began to investigate the issue. Well, 5 months after the hearings took place, a forensic pathologist named Dr. Emily Ward became the new Mississippi State Medical Examiner, and she agreed to review the autopsy reports for Andre and a number of the other inmates who had died under questionable circumstances at Mississippi jails. Dr. Ward concluded that it was extremely unlikely that any of these deaths were not suicides, but Andre's family was not swayed by this, and in February of 1994, his story would be featured on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries. However, by the time the episode aired, the Department of Justice had concluded their investigation into the 47 jailhouse deaths. In their report, they were very critical of Mississippi's jail system, citing it for, quote-unquote, gross deficiencies due to unsanitary conditions and untrained employees. But in the end, they still failed to find conclusive evidence to overturn the original suicide rulings in any of the 47 cases, including Andre's. Andre's family would file lawsuits in both state and federal court, seeking $25 million in damages from the various agencies that they believe were responsible for Andre's death, including the Simpson County Sheriff's Office and the Brandon Police Department. Interestingly enough, while the lawsuits push forward the idea that Andre died in police custody as a result of homicide or negligence, it did acknowledge the possibility that his death was a suicide, as one passage read, quote, "Andre Jones either was killed or was placed by defendants in conditions and circumstances which psychologically caused him to kill himself," end quote. But both lawsuits ultimately wound up being dismissed, as U.S. District Judge Tom S. Lee stated, quote, "There are no facts alleged or substantiated which would support a finding of conspiracy," end quote. In a surprising postscript to this story, Simpson County Sheriff Lloyd Jones would end up becoming the victim of a homicide only 3 years after Andre's death. On the morning of October the 3rd, 1995, Jones and a trustee from the county jail named R.B. Lewis were both killed by fatal shotgun blasts outside Jones' home. The shooter was a man named Carl Ray Johnson, who had also shot his girlfriend, Mary Walker, by the side of the road, less than 2 miles away from the Jones residence, though she wound up surviving. After Johnson was arrested, he was charged with capital murder for shooting Jones, manslaughter for shooting Lewis, and aggravated assault for shooting Walker. When he went on trial for the crimes, Johnson tried to plead self-defense for the shootings, and interestingly enough, he claimed that Walker told him that the sheriff had molested and killed a young black man named Andre Jones. Johnson said that when he confronted Sheriff Jones about this outside his house and mentioned Andre's name, the sheriff yelled racial slurs at him and said he was, quote-unquote, too damn smart. Jones then allegedly ordered Lewis to shoot Johnson, which is why Johnson responded by killing them both in self-defense. Well, the jury did not buy Johnson's account, so he would be convicted on all three counts and receive sentences of life imprisonment for capital murder, 20 years for manslaughter, and 15 years for aggravated assault. As far as I can tell, the authorities do not believe that Andre's case had any connection to Sheriff Jones' murder. In 2013, Esther, who is now going by the name Esther Muhammad, published a book about Andre's death titled Mississippi Jail Hangings Behind the Magnolias. She maintains a website about his story at ncfpa.us, which stands for the National Center for Police Accountability, and continues to believe that her son was the victim of foul play. But the actual circumstances of how Andre died remain shrouded in controversy. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So as I'm sure you're well aware, The treatment of minorities by law enforcement has been one of the most heated topics in North America these past several years, and while Andre Jones's death generated a decent amount of publicity 3 decades ago, you can only imagine what the reaction would be if it took place in today's era of social media and Black Lives Matter. We have an 18-year-old black kid with no prior criminal record who dies in police custody in Mississippi, the state which arguably has the most troubling history of racism. To top it all off, his death takes place in a jail run by a sheriff who is not exactly a popular figure with the local black community, and Andre's mother and stepfather just happen to be activists. The obvious knee-jerk reaction is, how could this situation be anything but a racially motivated murder? Well, I fully admit that when I first learned about this story on Unsolved Mysteries, that was my immediate reaction, but upon closer scrutiny, this is a situation where you have to put logic ahead of emotion. Unsolved Mysteries featured a number of cases in which someone's death was ruled to be a suicide or an accident, but the victim's loved ones were certain that foul play had taken place, and were desperately trying to seek justice by having the death reclassified. During the intro, I compared this case to the death of Keith Warren, and while I can't say with 100% certainty that what happened to Keith was racially motivated, I've always felt that it was the most likely example of a so-called suicide from Unsolved Mysteries that had been staged by those who were responsible. But the key difference between Keith Warren and Andre Jones is that Keith's whereabouts were unaccounted for nearly 2 days before his body was found hanging from a tree in a wooded area, so there's no shortage of possibilities about what could have happened to him. Andre was in police custody at the time he died, and while it's easy to envision a scenario in which he was murdered and a hanging was staged to make his death look like suicide, the issue is that this would have had to take place inside the shower stall of a holding cell occupied by 11 other inmates. It would be one thing if Andre's death took place while he was in solitary confinement, but with one exception, nearly all of these cellmates have shared the same consistent story of Andre walking into the shower stall and never coming out until they found him hanging by his own shoelace. Diagrams of the layout of this L-shaped cell have been shown on Unsolved Mysteries and in newspaper articles about this case, and it's clear that the cell's corridors were a tight space lined with 7 bunk beds, some of which were in very close proximity to the shower. It seems impossible that a murder could take place in there without any of the other cellmates seeing or hearing anything. We do have this story from one of the inmates that Andre was brought into the shower in a wheelchair by correctional officers before his suicide was staged, but if he was telling the truth, at least 10 other cellmates would have needed to remain silent and shared a false cover story in order to cover up what happened. Yes, I suppose it's possible that the police could have frightened some of these guys into doing this, but it's been nearly 30 years, and no one else has ever come forward to share anything incriminating. If Andre's death was a murder, then it was a conspiracy which would have required a lot of people to keep their mouths shut. All that being said, when you couple in the fact that Andre was just one of 47 inmates who supposedly hanged themselves in Mississippi jails during a period of less than 6 years, you can understand why the whole situation looked suspicious. Even if every single one of those deaths was legitimately a suicide, this definitely points to a major systemic problem in the state, and if Andre didn't even deserve to be arrested to begin with, I can see why his loved ones would be outraged. To be fair, even though the Simpson County Jail had a reputation for being dangerous, it sounds like Andre's death was the only suicide by hanging to take place there, so it's not like this particular jail had a large epidemic of suicides. And while 47 fatal jail hangings over the course of nearly 6 years is abnormally high, 23 of these victims were white, which seems to go against the idea that this was specifically a racial issue. However, it must be noted that from 1988 until 1993, 52% of the reported number of jail suicides which took place in Mississippi involved black victims, whereas the national average for jail suicides involving black victims during this time period was only 16%. At the time, more than one-third of all inmate suicides in the U.S. occurred in the South, as Mississippi, Georgia, and Alabama were 3 states who had no regulations for their state jails and conducted no inspections. In fact, 1/4 of all jails in Mississippi had been under federal court orders for failing to meet national safety requirements. And while Andre's death was apparently the first one to take place at the Simpson County Jail under Sheriff Lloyd Jones's watch, he had been pushed to improve conditions there for several years, but rarely ever followed through. It seems like this whole problem finally got pushed to the forefront because Andre had a mother who was president of the local chapter of the NAACP, and a stepfather who was a Nation of Islam minister affiliated with the controversial Louis Farrakhan. So I'm sure it was inevitable that the primary issue became race rather than safety standards. Now, even though Andre's death brought mainstream publicity to the topic of jail suicides, there isn't much information about most of these other supposedly suspicious hanging deaths which took place during that time period. But one case which did get some additional exposure was the alleged suicide of 21-year-old David Scott Campbell, a black man who lived in the town of Philadelphia, Mississippi. On October the 9th, 1990, Campbell was arrested for assault and public drunkenness and taken to the Neshoba County Jail, where he was placed inside a drunk tank, a cell which is used to hold intoxicated inmates. Sometime after midnight, a power outage took place in the town which lasted for about an hour, but after the power came back on, Campbell was found hanging from the bars of his cell by a noose, which he had fashioned together with his jeans and a belt. Even though Campbell's death was officially ruled to be a suicide, rumors circulated that Campbell was murdered because he was known for dating white women, one of whom happened to be the daughter of a police officer from a nearby town. Campbell's body was embalmed without his family's consent before an autopsy could be performed, and the clothes he allegedly used to hang himself with went missing, which his family found suspicious since they claimed he never wore a belt. Honestly, since Campbell's death took place while he was inside a solitary cell during a power blackout, it would be easy to believe he was murdered and his suicide was staged, but like the rest of these Mississippi hanging deaths, a new investigation from the Department of Justice failed to uncover enough evidence to overturn the original suicide ruling. I think what adds an extra aura of suspicion to Campbell's case is that it took place in Philadelphia, which is notorious for being the site of the 1964 Mississippi burning murders. On June the 21st of that year, two Jewish civil rights activists, Andrew Goodman and Michael Schwerner, and one black activist, James Chaney, were arrested for speeding in Philadelphia and held in jail for several hours, but shortly after they were released, all three of them were murdered by the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, and members of local law enforcement were involved in the murders and the cover-up. This incident would cause such outrage that a federal investigation was launched, and several perpetrators would be charged and convicted for their roles in the crime. In 1988, the story would be adapted into the Academy Award-nominated film Mississippi Burning. Well, when the Commission on Human Rights Abuses in Mississippi held their hearing to look into the Mississippi jail deaths in 1993, the convener just happened to be James Chaney's brother, Ben Chaney, who stated, quote, "This is a continuation, it's a revival, of the fear that existed in Mississippi prior to 1964. These atrocities are just building up and are continuing," end quote. So that should give you an idea of how politically charged this whole situation was, even though there was no conclusive evidence that Andre Jones, David Scott Campbell, or any of these other 45 suicide victims were murdered. I think one of the biggest issues with researching Andre's story is that there are differing versions of certain events that took place, so it's hard to figure out the exact truth, and the situation was exacerbated by the local media. The Jackson Advocate, the area's black-owned newspaper, was convinced that a terrible injustice had taken place, but the area's main newspaper, the Clarion Ledger, featured a number of editorials from reporters who believed that Andre's death was a suicide, and they would even be critical of his family and the local activist groups for turning the whole situation into a race issue and stirring up racial tension. But of course, the Clarion Ledger also received criticism about their coverage from the local black population, who believed the paper was ignoring the fact that racism was still a huge problem in Mississippi, even though 3 decades had passed since the Civil Rights Movement. Well, no matter which side you take, the Clarion Ledger did raise some valid points, the most important of which is that after a lengthy investigation, the original suicide ruling was upheld by a number of different agencies, including the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology, the U.S. Attorney's Office, the FBI, and the Department of Justice. Even though an independent pathologist concluded that Andre was the victim of foul play, would all these organizations be willing to participate in a conspiracy to cover up Andre's death? Well, before we discuss the situation any further, let's start with the circumstances of how Andre was arrested. The first major complication of this case is that the Brandon Police Department and Andre's girlfriend, Tanisha Love, each have their own version of events that took place, and since this was still many years away from the invention of body cameras, we cannot be certain what the actual truth is. It seems like the only thing that can be agreed upon is that Andre was driving without his license on him in a truck which turned out to be stolen. Andre said that he recently borrowed the truck from a friend of his named Slim, and he may have legitimately had no idea it was stolen, but regardless, this still would have been grounds for the police to take him into custody. But the two aspects of this arrest which have always been denied by Tanisha is that Andre had an open container of beer inside the truck and was carrying a handgun which he attempted to toss out the window when he was pulled over. Tanisha also claims that Andre was taken away in leg shackles, which the Brandon PD have always denied. According to Tanisha, the police's entire attitude changed when Andre gave them his name, as the officers gathered together in a huddle before they made the decision to take him into custody. If you take her story at face value, the implication seems to be that the police recognized Andre's name because his mother and stepfather were prominent activists and decided to arrest him on trumped-up charges in retaliation. But what could Andre's family have done to ruffle feathers that badly and spark such a reaction from law enforcement? Well, as you know, Esther Jones Quinn was the president of the Jackson chapter of the NAACP, and at this particular point in time, the organization was actively lobbying to get a notorious white supremacist named Byron Della Beckwith retried for the murder of civil rights leader Medgar Evers, who was shot to death outside his home in Jackson in June of 1963. Della Beckwith was charged with the crime and went on trial on two separate occasions in 1964, but they both took place in front of all-white juries and ended in mistrials when they failed to reach a verdict. Well, even though 3 decades had passed, the Jackson NAACP were pushing for Della Beckwith to be prosecuted and put on trial for Evers' murder for the third time, and the whole thing finally came to fruition in February of 1994. This time, the jury consisted of 4 whites and 8 blacks who found Della Beckwith guilty of first-degree murder, and he received a sentence of life imprisonment. 2 years later, this story would be profiled in the movie Ghosts of Mississippi, where James Woods received an Academy Award nomination for his portrayal of Della Beckwith. Obviously, there were a number of Mississippi residents who were not happy with the idea of the NAACP dredging up one of the most infamous racially motivated murders in their state's history and charging Della Beckwith with the crime 3 decades after the fact. But would this have been enough to compel officers from the Brandon Police Department to arrest Andre Jones? Well, I went back and looked through the Clarion Ledger archives, and yes, Esther Jones Quinn was a public figure whose name did get printed in the newspapers because of her work with the Jackson NAACP. In fact, just 1 month before Andre's death, Esther received publicity over the organization's attempts to try to get the Confederate emblem removed from the Mississippi state flag, which I'm sure did not go over well with some people. But the issue is that Andre himself was not a public figure, so if he gave his name at the sobriety checkpoint, would the police have even known who his mother was? After all, Jones is a very common last name. And if the Brandon PD was so enraged by Esther's activism that they wanted to take it out on her son, why would they have him transferred to the Simpson County Jail in Mendenhall, 30 miles away? The official story is that Andre was sent there because of overcrowding at the Rankin County Jail, but if someone in power wanted to murder him and stage his death to look like a suicide, it's odd that they would transfer Andre to another jail, allow him to make a number of phone calls to his family, and then hold him for nearly 24 hours before he was killed. But on the other side of the coin, the one aspect of Andre's arrest I've always found problematic are the allegations that he admitted to being part of a gang and was photographed displaying gang signals with his hands. If you look at the media coverage of this case, virtually everyone who knew Andre, not just his family, said nothing but glowing things about him, and had a hard time believing he would ever be affiliated with a gang. Well, even though I'm skeptical that Andre was actually a member of a gang, I don't write off the possibility that he could have had friends who were involved with gangs or other criminal activity. After all, the stolen truck he was driving was borrowed from a friend of his. It's a bit odd how the Brandon PD heaped all this praise upon Andre for being one of the most cooperative people they had ever arrested, but the implication seems to be that since Andre had never been in trouble with the law before and wanted to get out of jail as quickly as possible in time to start college, he may have decided to offer up any information he could think of about gangs in hopes of getting himself off the hook. In fact, Brandon Police Chief Walter Tucker offered up the theory that one of the factors which may have driven Andre to suicide was fear that he would face retribution from some of the gang members he knew for being a quote-unquote snitch. However, I find it troubling that these alleged photos of Andre showcasing gang signals have never been released publicly, as the Brandon PD turned down requests from Andre's family and Unsolved Mysteries to see copies of them. But I should mention that an article about the case in the October 8, 1992 edition of the Clarion Ledger contains this line, quote, "Police made 17 Polaroid photographs. The person flashing the gestures is wearing a baseball jersey identical to what Jones wore in his booking mugshot," end quote. So I'm not sure if this means that someone at the newspaper personally saw the photos and confirmed their existence, even though they were not actually published. But if this story about the photos is completely fabricated, I wonder if the authorities did this to push forward the idea that Andre was involved in criminal activity. Even if they had no actual involvement in his death, they might have done this to provide further validation for their decision to arrest him. The Quinns have always maintained that during their phone conversations with Andre while he was in jail, he told them he had no idea what he had been arrested for, but it's possible he was downplaying the situation because he was embarrassed to admit to his family that he had done something wrong. It would be one thing if Andre was innocently driving around in a truck which he had no idea was stolen, but if the police's story about his arrest is 100% true, and he tossed a .38 caliber handgun out the window, that's a lot more troubling, and was the one offense which could have led to Andre receiving serious jail time and potentially ruining his prospects for college. The only follow-up we've heard about the gun is that Andre supposedly told the police he bought it on the streets of Jackson 1 year earlier, but it doesn't sound like anyone was able to substantiate this. If you believe Tanisha's version of events, the story about the gun is completely fabricated, and Andre was not carrying one to begin with. It seems like Andre's family never came to visit him in jail, because the people in charge told them that they were not allowed to, and while you might be wondering why they didn't attempt to bail him out, the police were technically not required by law to set bond for Andre until he had been incarcerated for 48 hours. Since Andre was arrested on an early Saturday morning, that might explain the delay in getting him in front of a judge. So we've got two eyewitnesses who have reportedly shared stories about Andre being mistreated while he was in police custody, but the problem is that these stories have only ever been shared secondhand by Charles X. Quinn during his Unsolved Mysteries interview. Charles claims that the inmate who was transported alongside Andre to the Simpson County Jail told him that the officers used racial slurs to threaten Andre for stealing a white man's truck. However, the same inmate, Archie Beaufort, was interviewed in the Clarion Ledger in the months following Andre's death, and while he did say that Andre feared that the police were going to pin something on him which could get him 15 years in prison, Beaufort never mentioned the use of the racial slur. Now, that's not to say that Charles is lying or that this incident didn't happen, and even if the police were not complicit in Andre's death, it's certainly possible they still could have used racial slurs in his presence. But let's not forget Andre was at the Simpson County Jail for around 18 to 19 hours before he died, so it's odd that the authorities would allow him to be there that long and make multiple phone calls to his family if they were planning to kill him. Of course, the other explanation is that Andre's death was not premeditated murder and that he could have been killed accidentally, perhaps when officers attempted to interrogate him or rough him up, and things went too far. The other story Charles shared which pointed to foul play was from an anonymous inmate who told him that officers took Andre from cell 6 to an unknown location and brought Andre back to the cell in a wheelchair before they staged his suicide in the shower stall. But like I mentioned earlier, I find it troubling that only one anonymous source has ever shared this story, and it was never corroborated by any of the other inmates from cell 6, many of whom have gone on the record to say that Andre walked into the shower on his own and denied that anything happened which pointed towards foul play. Again, I'm not saying that Charles is intentionally lying, as one of the inmates may very well have told him that story, but if the police caused Andre's death, you'd think they might have come up with a different cover story by claiming that Andre killed himself after they placed him in solitary confinement or something. Why take him back to cell 6 and stage his suicide in front of 11 other witnesses who could blow the lid off the whole thing? It's worth noting that 6 of the inmates from cell 6 were black, and 5 of them were white, so if there was a conspiracy to cover up a racially motivated murder, Would all but one of these men be willing to stay silent about it for 3 decades? Now, Dr. James Bryant, the independent pathologist who believed that Andre was the victim of a homicide, he stated that he found it more likely that Andre would have been killed by a fellow inmate rather than someone in law enforcement. Indeed, on the surface, it does seem a lot more plausible that one of Andre's cellmates could have followed him into the shower and strangled him from behind with one of his shoelaces before staging a hanging to look like a suicide. But like I've reiterated numerous times, the shower stall was surrounded by an L-shaped corridor where the inmates rested on bunk beds, and they've always maintained that there's no way Andre could have been attacked inside the stall without them seeing or hearing anything, and they have always stuck to the same consistent story. In addition, most of these other cellmates have been booked on non-violent, alcohol-related misdemeanor charges, so what would compel any of them to suddenly commit murder in the presence of several other witnesses? And why would the Simpson County Sheriff's Office fabricate a suicide cover story for a murder that was committed by an inmate? I don't know if this detail has any significance, but in one article about the case in the Clarion Ledger, it mentioned that one of the inmates from Cell 6 had been, quote-unquote, declared mentally incompetent. While this is just an assumption on my part, I have to wonder if this mentally incompetent inmate might have been the same person who shared the story about Andre in a wheelchair and was completely fabricating the whole thing. I'm sure you've probably noticed that in virtually every Unsolved Mysteries case about suspicious suicides, the victim's family will hire an independent expert who comes to a conclusion involving foul play, which is exactly what the family wants to hear, and that certainly applies in this case. But if you were to compare Dr. James Bryant with Dr. Stephen Hain, the pathologist who performed Andre's autopsy and ruled his death to be a suicide, I'm sure you would all agree that the former appears to have a lot more credibility. Dr. Hain's interview on Unsolved Mysteries comes across very awkwardly, and in the past 3 decades, Hain has become infamous enough that he currently has his own Wikipedia page because of all the controversy surrounding his medical practices. Long story short, at least 3 murder convictions from the state of Mississippi have been overturned after it was determined that the so-called expert testimony Hain provided at the trials was seriously flawed and his forensic misconduct would come under fire from the Innocence Project. For many years, it's estimated that Hain conducted between 80 to 90% of the criminal autopsies which took place in Mississippi, but the problem is that he was not officially certified to do so. Instead, he would basically act as a private contractor and charge the state $500 per autopsy, and the state went along with this because they didn't have to hire a full-time medical examiner, and he technically saved them some money. To put this into perspective, Hain conducted an average of between 1,500 and 1,800 autopsies per year, even though the National Association of Medical Examiners does not recommend performing more than 250. In fact, if a medical examiner performed more than 325 autopsies per year, the association would refuse to certify their practice. The backlash to Hain's work became so great that he was finally terminated from his position in August of 2008, and barred from performing any more procedures for the state of Mississippi. So if Hain was literally performing 6 or 7 times the recommended workload in order to make the maximum amount of money, then it's easy to believe that a number of his autopsy findings were flawed, including that of Andre Jones. However, that doesn't change the fact that Hain's findings in this case were reviewed by a number of different government agencies who all supported his conclusion that Andre's death was a suicide, and none of them supported Dr. Bryant's findings of homicide. So even though Hain was definitely a problematic figure, that doesn't necessarily mean he was wrong here. There has been dispute between Dr. Hain and Dr. Bryant about whether or not Andre had bruises on his body, but even if Dr. Bryant was correct, he had to acknowledge that the bruises could have been caused by another incident which took place in the jail prior to Andre's death. And while it might seem unlikely that Andre could have hanged himself from a shoelace tied to a grate that was 8 feet above the floor, tests apparently did show that it was physically possible, particularly if Andre bent down into a crouching position that cut off his circulation and caused him to go unconscious. I'm sure the controversy surrounding Hain's work only furthered the narrative that Andre was the victim of a murderous conspiracy, which was only amplified by the fact that he died within the jurisdiction of Simpson County Sheriff Lloyd Jones, who had a checkered history of racist behavior and mistreating blacks during the Civil Rights era. However, from what I read about him, it sounds like Sheriff Jones did mellow out a bit as he got older, and while he was still a polarizing figure, it's not like he had a history of black people dying under suspicious circumstances while in his custody either. Jones was very open about denying any involvement in Andre's death, and maintained that he had no idea who Andre and his family were at the time he was arrested, and I think the situation was further complicated when Jones himself became the victim of a murder. Following his death in 1995, the local media tried to paint Jones in the best possible light, and since he was mostly well-liked and well-respected by the area's white community, I think there was a number of people who did not appreciate him being falsely accused of a murder, which is ruled to be a suicide. I know that Jones's killer, Carl Ray Johnson, claimed that the shooting was self-defense because he told the sheriff he had heard about him molesting and killing Andre, but it sounds like this was purely a desperation tactic on Johnson's part, as he likely heard about the controversy surrounding Andre and attempted to use it as justification for Sheriff Jones threatening his own life, even though there was no truth to it. If Andre's death really was a suicide, then at most, it sounds like Sheriff Jones might have been guilty of not properly maintaining safety standards at the Simpson County Jail, which is why the suicide was able to take place to begin with. As troublesome as Dr. Hain may be, he did make a valid point when he defended his suicide ruling and stated, quote, "I could be wrong about the homicide, I don't think I am, but my main beef is the jailers. They're not watching them. They just put them in the slammer and leave them there." End quote. I have to admit that when I first became familiar with this case, the one thing that left me questioning whether Andre could have hanged himself was the fact that he still had one of his own shoelaces to begin with. I was always under the impression that everyone who was booked into jail had their shoelaces and belt confiscated in order to prevent such a situation from taking place. But it turns out that the Simpson County Jail had a policy which only required inmates under the age of 18 to hand over these items, which is why Andre got to keep his laces. And since cell 6 was not your traditional jail cell and had been converted from an L-shaped corridor, many of the inmates were kept out of sight from the guards, which is why Andre would be able to enter the shower stall and hang himself without anyone noticing for 40 to 45 minutes. Also, this stall was apparently so dimly lit that you needed a flashlight to properly see in there, which presents a bunch of other safety issues. It does not sound like cell 6 was particularly well maintained, and I'm sure it was not pleasant for Andre to be incarcerated there for upwards of 18 hours, which might have taken a toll on his mental health. This seems to have been a recurring theme in a lot of the Mississippi jails, where the Department of Justice investigated no less than 47 suicides via hanging. In fact, the Neshoba County Jail, where David Scott Campbell hanged himself in 1990, was deemed to have such bad conditions that the DOJ recommended that it be closed immediately. So yes, if Andre did genuinely take his own life, his death did shine a light on a major systemic issue which was taking place in Mississippi, but that still doesn't answer the question of why he would decide to hang himself. It would be one thing if he knew he was facing many years in these conditions, but he had not even appeared in court yet. I mentioned earlier that during their transfer to Simpson County, Archie Buford had said that Andre had expressed concern that the police were going to pin something on him which could have led to 15 years in prison. After he arrived at the jail, some of Andre's cellmates confirmed that he had been asking questions about Parchman, which is the Mississippi State Penitentiary and is known for being a particularly rough prison. It seemed apparent that Andre was worried he would be sent there, though Garrison Spahn said he tried to assure him that since he had no prior arrest record and the charges he was facing were minor, Andre would likely only get probation. But of course, we can't even be certain if Andre actually was guilty of any of these charges, or if he might have been involved in more serious criminal activity involving gangs, which we don't even know about. Well, regardless of Andre's guilt or innocence, he was scheduled to start college only a day or two after he was arrested, so no matter what, there was a good chance these charges were going to interfere with that and possibly destroy his future. So I want you to take the next piece of information I share with a huge grain of salt, but on October the 15th, 1992, the McGee Courier, the official newspaper of Simpson County, published a letter to the editor from a Mendenhall resident named John Edwards. I have no idea who this guy is or how he fits into everything, but he claimed that the local authorities allowed him to view all their files on Andre Jones's death, and he found and shared some pieces of information I have never heard anywhere else. Here's an excerpt of what Edwards wrote, quote, "A black female inmate, serving as a cook, tried to console him by saying his mom would probably come get him and he told me that his mom didn't give a damn about him. So I told him to call his dad. He said, my dad is remarried and lives in Louisiana, and that the only people who gave a damn about him was his gang members. He said his mom, parent, husband didn't like him either. When asked by Brandon officers why he joined a gang, Andre replied, peer pressure, and that his mother, Esther Quinn, had not shown him much loving or care because she had too much of other things to do. What he couldn't get at home, the gang provided for him, such as love and attention, friendship, and sometimes money. The above is taken verbatim from files open to the public. End quote. Again, I have no idea how true this information is, as I have not read about Andre's comments to the female cook anywhere else. Some of the information shared there is not entirely accurate, as Andre's birth father, Alonzo Jones, lived in Port Gibson, Mississippi, not Louisiana, but since the McGee Courier was willing to print this letter, I hope that they at least did some fact-checking on the allegations. The letter does not paint a flattering picture of Andre's family life, and I certainly do not want to paint Esther and Charles in a bad light if these statements aren't true. But if they are true, then this might provide some insight into the internal pressure Andre was experiencing during his time in jail. L.C. Hayes, another inmate from Cell 6, made a statement in the Clarion Ledger which kind of hinted at this when he said, quote, like I told the FBI, I just don't believe anybody had anything to do with it. In my belief, like I told those NAACP men, I believe he just couldn't handle it. He figured he let his mama down. End quote. While Andre's family have always denied that he was involved in a gang, this is the only source I've seen which pushes forward the idea that Andre might have decided to join a gang because he felt he wasn't receiving the proper support at home. Of course, since Andre was college-bound and had no prior history of trouble with the law, I don't want to accuse him of this without independent verification, but regardless, it does open up the possibility that Andre may have elected to take his own life because he was too ashamed to face his family and found himself feeling despair and hopelessness. Look, I know that suicide is a very sensitive topic, and in some cases, like Keith Warren's, where a victim's family insists that their death was murder, you will come to the conclusion that suicide would have been impossible and the official cover story makes no sense. But in the case of Andre Jones, it's very difficult to come up with a scenario involving murder which holds together, barring a massive conspiracy where over a dozen people have managed to stay silent about the truth for nearly 30 years. But even if Andre did take his own life, I can understand the anger that his family and friends might feel against law enforcement for putting him in that situation to begin with. Even though Andre's family have always maintained that he was the victim of foul play, I have to hearken back to the lawsuits they filed, which contain this line, quote, Andre Jones either was killed or was placed by defendants in conditions and circumstances which psychologically caused him to kill himself, end quote. We will probably never know the real truth about whether Andre was guilty of anything other than driving a truck which he had no idea was stolen, but it sounds like he was a good kid overall, and as someone who had no prior history of trouble with the law, I'm sure being placed in jail was a traumatizing experience for him, particularly a place like the Simpson County Jail, which had less than stellar conditions. And if Andre genuinely believed that he could be facing years in these conditions, perhaps he felt that suicide was the only way out. It's an incredibly tragic story, and I feel nothing but the utmost sympathy for Andre and his family, yet while the circumstances make it easy to assume that this was a racially motivated murder, I just don't think the evidence supports it. I'm sure this whole situation caused a lot of simmering racial tension in the area to rise to the surface, but at the very least, Andre's death received enough national publicity that it did shine a light on a number of systemic issues in Mississippi and led to the federal government performing an investigation. Since none of these supposedly suspicious suicides were ever reclassified as homicides, I'm sure a number of the victims' families did not feel that justice was served, but I hope that Andre's story did lead to some positive changes for Mississippi's correctional system. All that being said, if you happen to have any information about the death of Andre Jones, which points to his death being a homicide, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. This past month, I released a special bonus episode about the unsolved disappearance of Mel Wiley, a police chief who vanished from Hinckley Township, Ohio in 1985. In addition, we've dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discuss the unsolved 2004 murder of Sarah Fox. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listener who has signed up with us on Patreon this week, and that's Hillary L. Thank you so much for your support. Also, in just 1 month, The Trail Went Cold will be appearing on Podcast Row at CrimeCon 2022, which is being held at Paris and Bally's in Las Vegas from April the 29th until May the 1st. If you would like to purchase tickets, we already have our own personalized promo code to receive a 10% discount off a standard badge. Please visit CrimeCon.com and enter the promo code TRAIL. Once again, go to CrimeCon.com and the promo code is TRAIL. And provided that it is safe enough to travel there, I'm also hoping to appear at CrimeCon UK, which is being held at the Leonardo Royal Hotel and Spa in London on June the 11th and 12th. If you would like to get a 10% discount on tickets to this event, please visit crimecon.co.uk and use the promo code COLE22. Once again, that's crimecon.co.uk and the promo code is 22. In addition, I wanted to provide another reminder that I hold live streaming sessions on a platform called Get Vocal. Every Thursday night from 7 until 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I host what is essentially an after-show for each week's podcast episode, where I have an interactive discussion about the featured case from said episode, and answer questions and address comments from listeners. I always include a link to these sessions in our show notes, so be sure to check there for more information, or visit getvocal.com. That's GETVOKL.com. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board, at the Sitcoms Online forum, and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourselves a great week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm